12. At the service, Bishop Timothy Archer read the D.H. Lawrence poem about the snake. He read it wonderfully, and I saw how moved the people were, although not many mourners had shown up. Not that many people knew Kirsten Lundborg. I kept seeking to locate her son Bill somewhere in the cathedral. When I had phoned him to tell him the news, he had showed little response. I think he foresaw it. At this time, the hospital and the House of Many Slammers held no power over him. Bill had earned his freedom to walk around or to paint cars or whatever he did. However, he currently amused himself in his earnest fashion. The cobwebs departed Bishop Archer's mind when Kirsten killed herself, so it would seem her death had served a useful purpose, although a purpose unequal to our loss. It amazes me, the sobering power of human death. It outweighs all words, all arguments. It is the ultimate force. It coerces your attention and your time, and it leaves you changed. How Tim could derive strength from death, the death of a person he loved, baffled me. I could not fathom it, but this was the sort of quality in him that made him good. Good at his job, good as a human being. The worse things got, the stronger he became. He did not like death, but he did not fear it. He comprehended it, once the cobwebs left. He had tried out the bullshit solution of seances and superstition, and that hadn't worked. It simply brought on more death. So now he shifted gears and tried out being rational. He had a profound motive. His own life had been placed on the line, like bait. Bait to tempt what the ancients called a sinister fate, meaning premature death. Death before its time. The thinkers of antiquity did not regard death per se as evil, because death comes to all. What they correctly perceived as evil was premature death, death coming before the person could complete his work, lopped off, as it were, before ripe, a hard green little apple that death took and then tossed away as being of no interest, even to death. Bishop Archer had by no means completed his work, and by no means did he intend to be lopped off, severed from life. He now correctly perceived himself sliding by degrees into the fate that had overtaken Wallenstein. First, the superstition and credulity, then run through with a halberd by an otherwise historically undistinguished English captain named Walter Devereux. Wallenstein had pleaded in vain for quarter. When the halberd is in the foe's hand, it is usually too late to plead for quarter. At that final instant, Wallenstein, roused from sleep, had probably also been roused from his mental stupor. I would guess that the swift realization came to him as the enemy soldiers broke into his bedroom that all the astrological charts and all the horoscopes in the world had been of no use to him, for he had not foreseen this and was caught. The difference between Wallenstein and Tim, however, was great and crucial. First, Tim had the advantage of Wallenstein's example. Tim got to see where folly led great men. Second, Tim was fundamentally a realist, for all his double-domed, educated flow of twaddle. Tim had entered the world with a wary eye, a keen sense of what benefited him and what worked to his disadvantage. At the moment of Kirsten's death, he had cannily destroyed part of her suicide note. No fool he, and he had been able, amazingly, to conceal their relationship from the media and from the Episcopal Church itself. It all came out later, of course, but by then Tim was dead and probably did not care. How an essentially pragmatic, even it could be argued opportunistic man, could involve himself in so much self-defeating nonsense is, of course, amazing, but even the nonsense had a sort of utility in the larger economy of Tim's life. Tim did not wish to be bound by the formal strictures of his role. He did not really define himself as a bishop, any more than he had previously let himself be defined as an attorney. He was a man, and he thought of himself that way. Not a man in the sense of male person, but man in the sense of human being who lived in many areas and spread out into a variety of vectors. In his college days, he had learned much from his study of the Renaissance. Once he had told me that in no way had the Renaissance overthrown or abolished the medieval world. The Renaissance had fulfilled it, whatever T.S. Eliot might imagine to the contrary. Take, for example, Tim had said to me, Dante's Commedia. Clearly, in terms of brute date of composition, the Commedia emanated from the Middle Ages. It summed up the medieval worldview, absolutely, its greatest crown. And yet, although many critics will not agree, the Commedia has a vast span of vision that in no way can be bipolarized to, say, the view of Michelangelo, who in fact drew heavily on the Commedia for his Sistine Chapel ceiling. Tim saw Christianity reaching its climax in the Renaissance. He did not view that moment in history as the ancient world revived and overpowering the Middle Ages, the Christian ages. The Renaissance was not the triumph of the old pagan world over faith, but rather the final and fullest flowering of faith, specifically the Christian faith. Therefore, Tim reasoned, the well-known Renaissance man, who knew something about everything, who was, to use the correct term, a polymath, was the ideal Christian, at home in this world and in the next. A perfect blend of matter and spirit, matter divinized, as it were, matter transformed, but still matter. The two realms, this and the next, brought back together, as they had been joined before the fall. This ideal Tim intended to capture for himself, to make it his own. The complete person, he reasoned, does not lock himself into his job, no matter how exalted that job. A cobbler who views himself only as one who repairs shoes is circumscribing himself viciously. A bishop, by the same reasoning, must therefore enter regions occupied by the whole man. One of these regions consisted of that of sexuality. Although the general opinion ran contrary to this, Tim did not care, nor did he yield. He knew what was apt for the Renaissance man, and he knew that he himself constituted that man in all his authenticity. That this trying out of every possible idea to see if it would fit finally destroyed Tim Archer can't be disputed. He tried out too many ideas, picked them up, examined them, used them for a while, and then discarded them. Some of the ideas, however, as if possessing a life of their own, came back around the far side of the barn and got him. That is history. That is an historical fact. Tim is dead. The ideas did not work. They got him off the ground and then betrayed him and attacked him. They dumped him, in a sense, before he could dump them. One thing, however, could not be obscured. Tim Archer could tell when he was locked in a life-and-death struggle, and upon perceiving this, he assumed the posture of grim defense. He did not, just as he had said to me the day Kirsten died, surrender. Fate, to get Tim Archer, would have to run him through. Tim would never run himself through. He would not collude with retributive fate once he spotted it and what it was up to. He had done that now, discerned retributive fate seeking him. He neither fled nor cooperated. He stood and fought, and in that stance, died. But he died hard, which is to say, he died hitting back. Fate had to murder him. And while fate figured out how to accomplish this, Tim's quick brain was totally engaged in sidestepping through every mental gymnastic move possible, that which perhaps held in it the force of the inevitable. This is probably what we mean by the term fate. Were it not inevitable, we would not employ that term. We would instead speak of bad luck. We would talk about accidents. With fate, there is no accident. There is intent. And there is relentless intent, closing in from all directions at once, as if the person's very universe is shrinking. Finally, it holds nothing but him and his sinister destiny. He is programmed against his will to succumb, and in his efforts to thrash himself free, he succumbs even faster, from fatigue and despair. Fate wins, then, no matter what. A lot of this Tim himself told me. He had studied up on the topic as part of his Christian education. The ancient world had seen the coming into existence of the Greco-Roman mystery religions, which were dedicated to overcoming fate by patching the worshipper into a god beyond the planetary spheres, a god capable of short-circuiting the astral influences, as it had been called in those days. We ourselves now speak of the DNA death strip and the psychological script learned from, modeled on, other previous people, friends and parents. It is the same thing. It is determinism killing you no matter what you do. Some power outside of you must enter and alter the situation. You cannot do it for yourself, for the programming causes you to perform the act that will destroy you. The act is performed with the idea that it will save you, whereas, in point of fact, it delivers you over to the very doom you wish to evade. Tim knew all this. It didn't help him, but he did his best. He tried. Practical men do not do what Jeff did and Kirsten did. Practical men fight that drift because it is a romantic drift, a weakness. It is learned passivity. It is learned giving up. Tim could ignore his son's death as unique, reasoning that no contagion was involved. But when Kirsten went the same way, Tim had to change his mind, return to Jeff's death, and reappraise it. He saw in it now the origins of later disaster, and he saw that disaster shaping up for himself. This caused him immediately to jettison all the claptrap notions that he had picked up, beginning with Jeff's death, all the weird and shabby ideas associated with the occult, to borrow Menotti's apt phrase. Tim suddenly realized that he had seated himself at the table in Madame Flora's parlor for the purpose of contacting the spirits, for the purpose, really, of delivering himself over to folly. He now did what characterized him throughout his life. He abandoned that route and sought another. He dumped that malicious cargo and reached around for something more stable, more durable and sound, to replace it. If the ship is to be saved, cargo must sometimes be flung overboard. When something is jettisoned, it is dumped calculatedly, heaved away to float off, leaving the ship intact. This moment only comes when the ship is in trouble, as Tim now was. Dr. Garrett had pronounced doom on both himself and Kirsten, beginning with Kirsten. The first prophecy had come true. He could expect, then, to be next. These are emergency procedures. They are employed by the desperate and the smart. Tim was both, and out of necessity. Tim knew the difference between the ship, which was not expendable, and the cargo, which was. He viewed himself as the ship. He viewed his faith in spirits, in his son's return from the next world, as cargo. This clear distinction was his advantage, inasmuch as he could discern it. Throwing away his beliefs did not compromise him, nor did it vitiate him, and there existed a slight chance that it might save him. I rejoiced in Tim's newfound lucidity, but I felt deeply pessimistic. I viewed his clear-headedness as a surfacing of his basic determination to survive. This is a good thing. You cannot fault the drive to endure. The only question that frightened me was, had it come soon enough? Time would tell. When the ship is saved, if it is saved, necessary jettison gives the right of general salvage to the owner or owners of the goods. This is an international rule of the seas. This is an idea basic to human beings, of whatever place of origin. Tim consciously or unconsciously understood this. In doing what he was doing, he partook of something venerable and universally accepted. I understood him. I think anybody would. This was not the time to whine over lost battles involving the issue of whether or not his son had returned from the next world. This was the time for Tim to fight for his life. He did so. And he did the very best he could. I watched, and where possible, I helped. It failed in the end, but not for want of effort, not for a failure of trying, a decline of nerve. This is not expedience. This is rousing oneself to a final defense. To view Tim in his final days as a cheap man devoted to animal survival at all costs, abandoning all moral conviction, is to misunderstand totally. When your life is at stake, you act in certain ways if you are smart, and Tim acted in those ways. He dumped everything that could be dumped, should have been dumped. He bared his dog tooth and offered to bite, and that is what a man does in the sense of man the creature who is determined to survive, and to hell with the cargo. Upon Kirsten's death, Tim stood in danger of imminent death himself, and he understood it. And for you to understand him in that final period, you must take his realization into consideration, and you must also understand that his perception, his realization, was correct. He was, as the therapists put it, in touch with the reality situation, as if there is some kind of distinction between situation and reality situation. He desired to live. So do I. Presumably, so do you. Then you should be able to figure out what Bishop Archer had in mind during the period following Kirsten's death and preceding his own. The first a given, the second an ominous but dubitable possibility. Not a reality, not then, at least, although from our standpoint now, as hindsight, we can comprehend it as inevitable. But this is the famous nature of hindsight. To it, everything is inevitable, since everything has already happened. Even if Tim regarded his own death as inevitable, willed by prophecy, willed by the Sibyl, or by Apollo speaking through the Sibyl as a mouthpiece, he was determined to confront that fate and put up the best fight he could manage. I think that is quite remarkable and to be lauded, that he jettisoned a whole lot of claptrap that he once believed in and preached is of no importance. Should he have hugged all that crap and died in a curled-up abreactive posture, his eyes shut, his dog tooth not bared? I am of firm conviction in this. I saw it. I fathomed it. I saw the cargo go. I saw it heaved overboard the instant Dr. Garrett's first prophecy came true. And I said, thank God. I think, though, he should have withdrawn that goddamn book from publication. That Here, Tyrant Death, as I had titled it. But he did have $30,000 riding on it, and perhaps this determination to let it get into print was simply further evidence of his practicality. I don't know. Some aspects of Tim Archer remain a mystery to me, even to this day. It simply was not Tim's style to abort a mistake before it happened. He let it happen, and then, as he put it, he filed a correction in the form of an amendment. Except insofar as his physical survival was involved. There he calculated activity in advance. There he looked ahead. The man who had run through his own life, outpacing himself, outdistancing himself as if urged on by the amphetamines he daily swallowed, that man now all at once ceased to run, turned instead, gazed at fate, and said as Luther is supposed to have said, but did not, "Here I stand, I can do not otherwise." Hier stehe ich, ich kann nicht anders. The German ontologist Martin Heidegger has a term for that, the transmutation of inauthentic being to true being, or sein. I studied that at Cal. I didn't think I would ever see it happen, but it did, and I did. And I found it beautiful, but very sad, because it failed. Within my mind, I conceived of the spirit of my dead husband penetrating my thoughts and being highly amused. Jeff would have pointed out to me that I viewed the bishop as a cargo ship, a freighter bearing its dog tooth, a mixed metaphor which would have kept Jeff in a state of rapture for days. I would never have heard the end of it. My mind had begun to go due to Kirsten's suicide. At work, comparing the content of shipments to the listings on the invoices, I barely noticed what I did. I had withdrawn. My fellow workers and my boss pointed this out to me. And I ate little. I spent my lunch hour reading Delmore Schwartz, who, I am told, died with his head in a sack of garbage that he had been carrying downstairs when he suffered his fatal heart attack. A great way for a poet to go. The problem with introspection is that it has no end. Like Bottom's dream in A Midsummer Night's Dream, it has no bottom. From my years at Cal in the English department, I had learned to make up metaphors, play around with them, mix them, serve them up. I am a metaphor junkie, overeducated and smart. I think too much, read too much, worry about those I love too much. Those I loved had begun to die. Not many remained here. Most had gone. They are all gone into the world of light, and I alone sit lingering here. Their very memory is far and bright, and my sad thoughts doth clear. As Henry Vaughan wrote in 1655. The poem ends, "Either disperse these mists which blot and fill my perspective still as they pass, or else remove me hence unto that hill, where I shall need no glass." By glass, Vaughan means a telescope. I looked it up. The 17th century minor metaphysical poets constituted my specialty during my school years. Now, after Kirsten's death, I turned back to them, because my thoughts had turned, like theirs, to the next world. My husband had gone there. My best friend had gone there. I expected Tim to go there soon, and thus he did. Unfortunately, I began now to see less of Tim. This, for me, acted as the worst strike of all. I really loved him, but now the ties had been severed. They got severed from his end. He resigned as Bishop of the Diocese of California, and moved down to Santa Barbara and the think tank there. His book, which in my eternal opinion should have been suppressed, had come out to indict him as a fool. This, combined with the scandal about Kirsten, the media, despite Tim's tampering with evidence, had caught on to their secret relationship. Tim's career with the Episcopal Church ended suddenly. He packed up and left San Francisco, surfacing in, as he had put it, the private sector. There he could relax and be happy. There he could live his life without the repressive strictures of Christian canon law and morality. I missed him. A third element had blended in to terminate his relationship with the Episcopal Church, and that, of course, consisted of the goddamn Zadokite documents, which Tim simply could not leave alone. No longer involved with Kirsten, she being dead, and no longer involved with the occult, since he recognized that for what it was, he now concentrated all his credulity on the writings of that ancient Hebrew sect, declaring as he did in speeches and in interviews and articles that here indeed lay the true origins of the teachings of Jesus. Tim could not leave trouble behind him. He and trouble were destined to join company. I kept abreast of developments concerning Tim by reading magazines and newspapers. My contact came second-hand. I no longer had direct personal knowledge of him. For me, this constituted tragedy, more perhaps than losing Jeff and Kirsten, although I never told anyone that, even my therapists. I lost track, too, of Bill Lundborg. He drifted out of my life and into a mental hospital, and that was that. I tried to track him down, but failing, gave up. I was either batting 0 or 1,000, whichever way you want to compute it. Whichever way you want to compute it, the results came out to this. I had lost everyone I knew, so the time had arrived to make new friends. I decided that retail record selling was more than a job. For me, it amounted to a vocation. Within a year, I had risen to the post of manager of the musique shop. I had unlimited powers to buy. The owners put no ceiling on me, none at all. My judgment alone determined what I ordered or did not order, and all the salesmen, the representatives of the various labels, knew it. That earned me a lot of free lunches and some interesting dates. I started coming out of my shell, seeing people more. I wound up with a boyfriend, if you can abide such an old-fashioned term. It would never be employed in Berkeley. Lover, I guess, is the word I want. I let Hampton move into my house with me, the house Jeff and I had bought, and began what I hoped was a fresh, new life in terms of my involvements. Tim's book, Here Tyrant Death, did not sell as well as had been expected. I saw remaindered copies at the different bookstores near Sather Gate. It had cost too much and rambled on too long. He would have done better to shorten it, insofar as he had written it. Most of it, when I finally got around to reading it, struck me as Kirsten's work. At least she had done the final draft, no doubt based on Tim's bang-bang dictation. That was what she had told me, and probably it was the case. He never followed it up with an amending sequel, as he had promised me. One Sunday morning, as I sat with Hampton in our living room, smoking a joint of the new seedless grass and watching the kids' cartoons on TV, I got a phone call, unexpectedly, from Tim. "Hi, Angel," he said in that hearty, warm voice of his. "I hope this isn't a bad time to call you."
"It's fine," I managed to say, wondering if I really heard Tim's voice or if, due to the grass, I was hallucinating it. "How are you? I've been..."
"The reason I'm calling," Tim interrupted, as if I had not been speaking, as if he did not hear me, "is that I'll be in Berkeley next week. I'm attending a conference at the Claremont Hotel, and I'd like to get together with you."
"Great,"
I said, immensely pleased. "Can we get together for dinner? You know the restaurants in Berkeley better than I do. I'll let you pick whichever one you like." He chuckled. "It'll be wonderful to see you again, like old times." I asked him, haltingly, how he had been. "Everything down here is going fine," Tim said. "I'm extremely busy. I'll be flying to Israel next month. I wanted to talk to you about that."
"Oh," I said, "that sounds like a lot of fun."
"I'm going to visit the Wadi," Tim said, "where the Zedekite documents were found. They've all been translated now. Some of the final fragments proved extremely interesting. But I'll tell you about that when I see you."
"Yes,"
I said, warming to the topic. As always, Tim's enthusiasm was contagious.
"I read a long article in Scientific American. Some of the last fragments..."
"I'll pick you up Wednesday night," Tim said, "at your house. Be formally dressed, if you would."
"You remember..."
"Oh, of course. I remember where your house is."
It seemed to me he was speaking ultra rapidly. Or had the grass affected me? No, the grass would slow things down. I said in panic, "I'm working at the store on Wednesday night."
As if he hadn't heard me, Tim said, "About 8 o'clock. I'll see you then. Goodbye, dear." Click. He had rung off.
"Shit," I said to myself. "I'm working until 9 Wednesday night. Well, I will just have to get one of the clerks to fill in for me. I am not going to miss having dinner with Tim before he leaves for Israel." I wondered then how long he would be over there. Probably for some time. He had gone once before and planted a cedar tree. I remembered that. The news media had made quite a bit of it.
"Who was that?" Hampton said, seated in jeans and a t-shirt before the TV set. "My tall, thin, acerbic boyfriend, with his black wire hair and his glasses."
"My father-in-law," I said.
"Former father-in-law."
"Jeff's father," Hampton said, nodding.
A crooked grin appeared on his face.
"I have an idea as to what to do with people who suicide. I think it should be a law that when they find someone who's suicided, they should dress him up in a clown suit and photograph him that way, and print his picture in the newspaper like that, in the clown suit, such as Sylvia Plath, especially Sylvia Plath."
Hampton went on then to recount how Plath and her girlfriends, according to Hampton's imagination, used to play games in which they'd see who could stick their head in the oven of the kitchen stove the longest, meanwhile all of them going tee-hee, giggling and breaking up.
"You're not funny," I said, and walked from the room into the kitchen.
Hampton called after me, "You're not sticking your head in the oven, are you?"
"Go fuck yourself," I said, "with a big red rubber bulb for a nose."
Hampton was droning on, mostly to himself. His voice and the racket of the TV set, the kids' cartoons, assailed me. I put my hands over my ears to shut out the noise.
"Head out of the oven," Hampton yelled.
I walked back into the living room and shut off the TV set. Turning to face Hampton, I said, "Those two people were in a lot of pain. There's nothing funny about someone who's in that much pain." Grinning, Hampton rocked back and forth, seated curled up on the floor.
"And big floppy hands," he said. "Clown hands."
I opened the front door. "I'll see you. I'm going for a walk." I shut the door after me. The front door swung open. Hampton came out on the porch, cupped his hands to his mouth, and called,
"Tee-hee! I'm going to stick my head in the oven. Let's see if the babysitter gets here in time. Do you think she'll get here in time? Anybody want to make a bet?"
I did not look back. I kept on going. As I walked along, I thought about Tim, and I thought about Israel and what it must be like there. The hot climate, the desert and the rock, the kibbutzim. Tilling the soil, the ancient soil that had been worked for thousands of years,
farmed by Jews long before the time of Christ. Maybe they would direct Tim's attention to the ground, I thought, and away from the next world, back to the real, back to where it belonged. I doubted it, but perhaps I was wrong. I wished then that I could go with Tim, quit my job at the record store, just take off and go, maybe never return, stay in Israel forever, become a citizen, convert to Judaism, if they'd have me. Tim could probably swing it. Maybe in Israel I'd stop mixing metaphors and remembering poems. Maybe my mind would give up trying to solve problems in terms of recycled words, used phrases, bits ripped from here and there, fragments from my days at Cal, in which I had memorized but not understood. Understood but not applied. Applied but never successfully. A spectator to the destruction of my friends, I said to myself. One who records on a notepad the names of those who die, and did not manage to save any of them, not even one. I will ask Tim if I can go with him, I decided. Tim will say no. He has to say no. But nonetheless, I will ask. To root Tim in reality, I realized, they will first have to get his attention. And if he is still on the decks, it will not be possible for them to do that. His mind will be tripping and freewheeling and spinning forever out into the void, conceiving the great models of the heavens. They will try, and like me, they will fail. If I go with him, maybe I can help, I thought. The Israelis and I maybe could do what I never could do alone. I will direct their attention to him, and they in turn will direct his attention to the soil under their feet. Christ, I thought, I have to go with him. It's essential, because they will not have time to notice the problem. He will skim his way across their country, be first here, then there, never lighting, never coming to rest long enough, never letting them... A car honked at me. I had wandered out onto the street, crossing unconsciously, without looking. Sorry, I said to the driver, who glared at me. I am no better than Tim, I realized. I'd be no help in Israel. But even so, I thought, I wish I could go.